Good morning and welcome to this segment of Your Morning Wake-Up Call. I'm your host, MK. We just finished celebrating February as Black History Month, a time to celebrate the achievements by African Americans as well as an opportunity to reflect and inspire action. Today, we keep that action and inspiration alive by bringing on author Nikki Jones, an award-winning associate professor of African American Studies at UC Berkeley and author of the new book, The Chosen Ones, Black Men and the Politics of Redemption. She isn't speaking on the intersection of race, gender, and justice, or being called on to help the community make sense of racial conflicts. She's researching the systemic racism in our criminal justice system in order to improve the lives of young people in our inner cities, analyzing interviews with police officers and reviewing video recordings of encounters between the police and the public. She seeks to understand why some police encounters go so badly so quickly, and what we can do to prevent it from happening. Welcome, Nikki Jones. It's a pleasure to have you on our show.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. In The Chosen Ones, you share a very compelling story of a group of Black men living in San Francisco's historically Black neighborhood, the Fillmore. And against all odds, these men work to atone for past crimes with the hope of guiding them toward a better life. How do neighborhood politics, everyday interactions with the police, and conservative Black gender ideologies shape the men's ability to make good and forgive themselves?
So what struck me about when I was doing the work, when I started doing this work in 2007, and the broader period was 2005 to 2010, but I actually moved to the neighborhood in 2007. And I was struck by the way that this small group of men was working together, relying on one another, trying to help each other in the process. And that although they were doing that work, they weren't actually interwoven into the neighborhood social order. So in some ways, they were excluded. And that struck me, right, because you're in a setting in which you would think that there would be all hands on deck for this kind of effort, because it was a neighborhood that did experience episodes of violence, and there was a real concern about that. So as a sociologist, the question to me is, well, how is that so, and why is that so? And the book seeks to answer that question. And one of the answers to that question is that at that time, there was what I describe as a crime-fighting community whose job it was to manage public safety in the neighborhood. And that required a particular kind of organization and a particular kind of representation. It required the representation of the credentialed class, what I describe as the Black credentialed class, and a very rigid kind of social order when it came to addressing the problem of crime and violence. So that even some people, like the men I was following, who might be closer to the street and the problems and the people, even though they were there as a resource, they weren't actually drawn on as a resource. And that crime-fighting community, what was interesting, especially now in hindsight, is that crime-fighting community was a progressive way of addressing the problem of crime and violence. It thought to be a progressive way of addressing the problem of crime and violence at that time period. And so there was the politics of crime-fighting encouraged organization of the crime-fighting community in a particular way. In a way that ultimately, I argue, actually made some young people more vulnerable to violence and to the criminal justice system. So those are the different ways that the politics of crime fighting shape, you know, the process of redemption for people in neighborhoods like the Fillmore.
So how do the politics of the crime fighting community, the law enforcement, the officers, the youth mentors, the faith leaders, how do they often hurt the people they're trying to help? How does that happen?
So I'll tell you a little bit about the construction of the crime-fighting community and what I mean by that. And there's both a rhetoric and an ideology that the crime-fighting community is organized around, and it goes back to a popular way or way of addressing the problem of violence in the 90s that became really popular for a number of reasons. One, it was thought to be progressive, it was thought to be evidence-based, and it looked like it actually influenced the violence that was happening in neighborhoods. It was referred to then as the Boston Miracle, and then evolved into what is described as ceasefire, and now has evolved into another iteration. But the basic core of that is that there are three communities and neighborhoods that experience violence like this. The community of decent law-abiding people, the community of law enforcement, and the community of people who are most likely to be involved in the violence. And the idea, and again, it was a progressive idea at the moment, was to target those who are most likely to be involved in the violence. And one of the things that you saw is that you recruit members of the community to participate in legitimizing the targeting of those members of the community who are most likely to be involved in the violence. But the solution is to say to those people, stop shooting, stop engaging in the violence, or else. And or else is the heavy hand of law enforcement, which can often mean arrest, and which is not a long-term solution, as we know, to the problem of violence. And the other politics that you had, the rhetoric that this is organized around, was the right to a crime-free community. So again, the idea that decent law-abiding people in the neighborhood had a right to a crime-free community, and for whatever that meant, right? And by any means necessary, you go about achieving that, even if that means inviting in greater degrees of intrusion from law enforcement into the community. And so what you typically see when you have that kind of those kinds of efforts is a short-term reduction in violence, but it's not a long-term solution. And what it does is make it seem to other people in the community like the primary responsibility of those who are being targeted is to law enforcement and not to other parts of the community. And law enforcement, especially when you're thinking about young people, it's not a great way, as we know, because of the failures in our criminal justice system, to encourage transformation. And there are actually more effective ways outside of law enforcement, more effective programs that can actually do the work of transformation and redemption and help young people break away from the street than these other kinds of targeted and what I would say heavy-handed approaches. And I would also say that these this kind of organization of crime fighting is on top of a host of other crime fighting efforts in communities like this, including person-based policing and place-based policing. So what you have in these neighborhoods is a web of surveillance, heightened degrees of intrusion. And in neighborhoods, and we know that even with the great crime decline, where people are safer in cities than they've ever been, that there are chronic there are neighborhoods in which violence is chronic. And so if this web of surveillance, if this degree of intrusion was actually the solution to the problem of violence, right, we would expect to see the violence go away entirely. And we haven't seen that. And in fact, I think what I'm arguing, what other scholars have been arguing, is that that persistent presence of the criminal justice system can actually have an erosive effect and can actually exacerbate violence in certain settings.
Yeah, in fact, can you sort of help us understand or put us into the situations of exactly why police encounters go badly so quickly? And then, of course, the question is, what can we do to prevent it? But take us into a situation to help the listener understand why a real-life scenario that really does, why things go bad so quickly.
Sure. And so I'll say two things. So the first thing is that we have to understand that things go badly in different settings in different ways for different reasons. And so the typical police civilian encounter is an encounter between strangers. That's the encounter that most of us have in our minds. But in the neighborhoods that I've studied, the relationship between the police and people in that neighborhood is much more of a personal relationship. It's much more of an intimate relationship. And because of that, the conflicts that emerge out of that are a bit different than when you have encounters between strangers. And so why do encounters between strangers, right, between police officers and people who don't know each other, why do they go, I should say people who don't have an expertise in interacting with the police, why do they go badly? Typically because the police and people are doing something very different at the beginning of encounters. And so at the beginning of police encounters, officers are typically collecting information. They want people to act in certain ways. They want people to position themselves in certain ways. And people are just being people, right? And so they're stopped. And typically what you have when people are stopped is a question, officer, why are you stopping me? An officer can either read that question as a question and respond to it, or they can read that as resistance. And one of the ways that, or I should say a lack of compliance, and one of the ways that these encounters go really badly, really quickly, is that collision that happens in the very beginning. So individuals are doing one thing. Something is happening to them. They want a set of responses, and the officers are doing something else, right? And when we see encounters go badly within a 15-second period, that can be one explanation. Another explanation, for example, if you take the case
I don't want to interrupt you, but this, I think any human can relate to this, because anytime anyone walks up to us with an accusatory tone, even if they don't mean it, it immediately puts the person on the defense. I mean, that just I just wanted to acknowledge that. I think that's a very human response. You know, not even race issues aside. Anytime someone, it's almost like coming with a verbal loaded gun, and so we have the desire to defend. Anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't want to interrupt.
Yes, that's exactly right. And so then the question is, well, how does race get into the equation? And one way it gets into the equation is certainly that officers can be brain conscious or unconscious biases about the people that they're interacting with that sets the kind of expectations that they have for them very early on in the encounter. And so if someone is approaching, if an officer is approaching a black person, for example, that black person in their lens may have a provisional status, right? They may be unsure of what this person is going to do, and then that might influence how they read those encounters. It's also the case that some black people can anticipate, right, that they're going to be seen as suspicious, and they may try to do things at the beginning of the encounter, like tell the officer who they are, tell the officer what they're doing, that the officer is then reading as a lack of compliance, right? And then, again, the encounter gets hijacked, right, by the officer wanting to reassert control or regain control, even if that means the physical use of force, right? And then that leads the encounter, what started as a minor a traffic stop, right, can end going all the way, right, to lethal force. The other way that race gets into the equation is there was a recent nationwide survey that found that 56% of officers agreed that in some neighborhoods you have to talk to some people in a more aggressive tone. So that means that there's a percentage of officers who believe, and we see this in our research as well, in interviews we've done with officers, who believe that you have to start higher up with some people. You have to start using a more aggressive tone, that you can't let certain people in certain neighborhoods, and typically they're talking about poor black neighborhoods or neighborhoods of colors, people who live in the projects, as some officers describe it. If you talk to them in a way, if you talk to them like professionals, right, as one of the respondents in our research describes it, right, then you risk being seen as weak and vulnerable in that setting, and because you are there all the time, because that's how policing is organized in those neighborhoods, then you're setting up the potential to be taken advantage of, right? So that's the belief that officers are kind of organized, or at least some percentage of officers are organized around. And so that, you know, influences the degree of aggression that's then displaced onto a community, because officers think that that's the way to police, right?
Yeah, it's an entire mindset.
Right.
And so who is the more qualified, really, to do the work of, say, saving a neighborhood or turning things around for a community? Where does it begin?
You know, and that's a difficult question, you know. And so where I enter that conversation is the question around violence and how do we address, right, the persistent violence in some pockets and neighborhoods in cities across the country. And so we've had the experiment where we've used law enforcement to do that for a long time. And what I suggest is that we need to invest in a different set of practices, right, and a different set of institutions when it comes to responding to the problem of violence. So it's very common now to use data to target institutional resources, right? And that institution can be law enforcement, but it could also operate from a public health model. It could operate from a youth development model. It can operate from a mentoring model. And the practices that I see that are most effective are those practices that actually buffer young people from the criminal justice system or the juvenile justice system and build bridges for those young people from where they are, right, to where they want to be. So then the question who is most qualified to do that, in fact, we should draw on all of the resources that are available in a community when it comes to building the capacity of individuals and community members. And we know for sure, right, that's not, even with the great transformation that's happening in the criminal justice system, that's not the intention of the criminal justice system, right, to build people up, right, to build capacity. It's oriented around a fundamentally different set of ideologies and practices. And so part of the work of the book is to show that we shouldn't, all hands should be on deck, right? We shouldn't discount people because we think that they're not, quote unquote, qualified enough, that they don't have enough education, that they haven't lived the kind of life that we think is a decent or respectable life. To the extent that people have gone through this transformation, they are incredible resources when it comes to helping other people make that same kind of transformation. And I think that it's short-sighted when we don't draw on those resources that exist.
Right. It's very similar to peer support. So the idea of not just of working together as a community. So you talk about the idea of helping getting the black credentialed class to embrace efforts to work within the community, but also to work with people, black men who have criminal histories. To work toward this endeavor as well. Can you speak to both sides of that and the benefits that both sides bring in?
Well, and so I should say the three of the key takeaway points of the book, mm-hmm. and I should say that this is what sociologists do. You know, we take things that seem really obvious and spend a lot of time explaining it. But these are the three key points. Change takes time. For young people, you should predict that their change trajectory is going to be characterized by setbacks and successes, and relationships are transformative. Right? Relationships are transformative. Now, these are things that we know that's true in other settings. Right? When it comes to, like, for example, wellness and health, we understand how important relationships are and networks are, social networks. But somehow when we're talking about young people who might be involved with violence, we forget all of that. And so to understand that change takes time, what does that mean? That means that when people have programs, right, and when they're getting funding for programs, and that's what the credential class is good at, right, they can do that well. The evaluation of the success of that program can't be on a one-year period or two-year period or three-year period, especially if you're dealing with young people in the age range of 18 to 24, because change takes time. And if you stop at one point in your evaluation, what may look like a success, right, may not be. And what may looks like a failure may actually be a success, right? And so we need to adapt our program models, and this is what the credential class certainly can do, so that it actually fits the process of change, how it happens on the ground. And then certainly when it comes to relationships being transformative, people who have histories of incarceration or who have street histories, they can be ambassadors to the extent that they are accepted in other places, that there are institutional bridges for them to get to other places. So, for example, these programs in community college and even here at UC Berkeley for formerly incarcerated students. These programs are so important because these students go out as ambassadors and people who have experiences like them who are also trying to change their lives. Right? They have some idea of how to do it and who to rely on as a resource when they start to do that work. So in a kind of more holistic picture, and again, kind of troubling this question of who is the most qualified, that we have to identify the practices that we know are most effective when it comes to supporting young people in particular. We have to apply those set of practices to these young people, even though they're doing things that are deeply troubling. And we have to rely on the resources of the entire community to develop not only programs, right, because programs end, but a community context and institutional context that allow people the opportunity to do the work necessary, with all that comes with, to change their lives.
Yeah, much more, and you argue for a much more inclusive and liberating approach rather than that of crime fighting. So we need to start saying goodbye to law and order. It sounds like it may not be the answer.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's hard for people to admit that because they say, well, look at the great crime decline, right? We had these target practices in New York City. We've done it, and crime has gone down. And the fact is that crime went down everywhere, even in cities that didn't adopt the practices that New York City did. And what we know now, what we didn't know 30 years ago, even though some people told us that this is going to happen, but we didn't listen, is that any contact with the criminal justice system is bad for young people. Right? It is not an institution that is invested in healthy adolescent development. And when you have a young person who is troubled or vulnerable, what you want is not punishment, right? You want to invest in them. You want healing. You want restoration. And if you don't want it, we should want it, right? Even for these young people. And so I do think, and one of my great concerns with the new administration, it's not the new administration anymore, was this taking up, this re-embrace of law and order, when we had gotten to a point where many people realized on both sides of the aisle the damage that that had done, right, over the last 30 years. And so my hope is that on the local level, and I see this happening, is that people are keeping up the momentum when it comes to thinking in new ways about how to handle persistent problems, like the problems of violence.
Yeah, speaking of, what are the potential pitfalls and benefits of Kamala Harris's criminal justice reform as the 2020 presidential campaign takes shape?
Yeah, that's right. And so I mentioned earlier that the kind of crime-fighting politics that I was writing about at the time were, you know, San Francisco, you know, is a liberal and progressive city. Kamala Harris was a district attorney for a period when I was doing my field work. Gavin Newsom was mayor. There's a new mayor's office of criminal justice. So this wasn't coming down from, you know, from a kind of malevolent, you know, ideology or approach. This was imagined to be the way to be progressive at that time. And what we've had post-Ferguson, right, is an understanding that type of progressive is no longer progressive. Right? What is progressive today is trying to disentangle people from the criminal justice system. What is progressive today is disinvesting, divestment in the criminal justice system and all of its related apparatuses, not relying on the heavy hand of law enforcement to compel change. And I think one of the challenges that Kamala Harris faces is that she is not recognizing the differences, right, the kind of temporal differences in what it means to be progressive. And at the same time, she is doubling down in the way, you know, and kind of embracing her prosecutor identity on the need in particular, right, to punish people for violent offenses. And what we know is that mass incarceration wasn't only driven by changes in sentencing for drug offenses. It was also driven by changes in sentencing for violent offenses. And we also know that just like other forms of deviance and criminality, people tend to age out of violent offending. So the idea that you could throw a person's life away, not for drug offenses anymore, but still for violent crimes, that's not actually progressive. That's not what progressive means in this moment. And so I think that to the extent that you know, she doesn't recognize that, I think that she will certainly have challenges selling and has had challenges selling herself as a progressive.
Yeah, the progressive definition of progressive is absolutely changing, it seems. And we hardly have any time left, but I just want to touch base on this because I think it's also important. You talk about the importance of inner youth and families also being involved and encouraged to even if, you know, to have dreams and to strive for themselves and each other. Can you talk about that as in including the family as an important piece of the unit in preventing future violence from kids or future offenses?
You know, one of the things that I take away from the work, and it's hard work because the violence is real and it is devastated families and members of the community for sure. But even under those conditions, people are still trying to change their lives. They're caring for one another. Are they relying on each other as resources? And for people who are interested in addressing the problem of violence, I think the question is, how do you invest in that? And when it comes to the family, the danger that we can sometimes fall into is a kind of moral evaluation of which type of families deserve investing in. And on the face of it, because of you know, preconceived stereotypes and preconceived notions of black families and poor black families, people often think that these families need punishment, right, not investment. And so what I would say is that we need to invest in relationships that build up the buffers that are necessary to protect people from the shocks and that they could experience if they come in contact with the criminal justice system, but also to not romanticize how much a quote unquote decent family can do. And so one of former President Obama's frequent refrains is that nothing keeps a young man out of the criminal justice system like a good father. And my experience on the ground was that, and my experience in general is that the kind of structural violence of racism in the criminal justice system far outmatches the wills and dreams of desires of a quote unquote good father. And so I think we need to invest in the capacity of relationships, both familiar relationships and non-kin relationships and communities. But we also have to be clear that the site of intervention is not the family, but the kind of structural circumstances in which families are coming up.
Yeah. Do you want to talk any more about any of your other findings? Your the biggest, any more big takeaways that we need to, that you think are important for the listeners to understand, or no?
No, I think that's good. Yeah. I mean, I think those three key takeaways, are important, bits, but yeah, no, I think that's fine.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much, Nikki Jones, for your revolutionary work. And it is also award-winning. Let's hope that the politicians hear and listen to the research that you've worked so hard to bring us, and the solutions that you propose. They certainly make sense.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
More than sense. So I think they really provide a hopeful way forward. We've been speaking with, again, the author, Nikki Jones, and the book is The Chosen Ones, Black Men and the Politics of Redemption. Thank you so much for joining us and taking a look at the impact of the kind of structural reform that needs to take place. It's important work you're doing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right. Well, we're done. And I got to tell you, wow. I said to Jessica, sometimes I don't have time to read books, but all the way through. But I love your message, and I love what you have to say. And this is the progressive voice that needs to be. Yeah, it needs to be heard, and it's and you find it on YouTube. But you're not finding it even in alternate. You're not finding it in the alternate, even in, like, I'm independent radio. But you don't even find it there anymore as much.
Oh,
it's,
wow.
As much. I mean, you find the old left, I feel like, has gone onto YouTube, you know?
Interesting, yeah.
And in the media, anyway, that's my experience. The old, you're finding it to some degree in some places, but they're few and far between, the pockets of a real progressive voice. And that's what, I wonder if we could even say this, but if we want to mention, or if you want to pull that together in any different way or say it better than I am, but we really are in a moment of redefining progressive, are we not?
I absolutely agree. And when I was talking about the what strikes me, particularly when it comes to criminal justice reform, you had people working on mass incarceration for 30 years. With policing, within 5 years, you saw a fundamentally different conversation. We moved from police reform, which was a progressive platform, to police accountability, right, which is a lot different from reform, and because it's about making the police accountable to the community, not just working with the police to do their job better. And so, yeah, I think that, you know, the last 5 years, including, you know, the recent election, has encouraged people to rethink the possibilities of progressive action. And in doing so, then redefining what it means to be progressive. And so now you see a lot of people trying to catch up to this new definition. And certainly some folks, you know, were already there. So I think, you know, as difficult as a time, it can be, it's also, I think, an exciting time when it comes to the transformative possibilities in certain moments and in certain places. And you certainly see this with criminal justice reform. But I think you see it in other areas as well.
Yeah, and the fact that you really look at it from a systemic point of view, and that you're saying, listen, you know, you can have all the great fathers in the world, but mm-hmm. it's about exposure to a systemic way of dealing with people, and if and in inherent and what is inherent in that system that is inherently flawed that we need to correct and find a better way.
That's right. And you see people doing this, for example, striking down the voting ban in Florida, addressing some of the issues with jury representation. So what people are doing are dismantling the infrastructure of racism from the Reconstruction period and the Jim Crow era that still exists in our criminal justice system. So if that still exists now in the 21st century, you can't just tell people to be better fathers. You can't just tell young people to pull their pants up. You have to fundamentally address the problems of structural racism that have lingered for centuries. And that's I think, where the potential for true transformation is, and dismantling, you know, that heavy, heavy history.
Yeah, and I also think it's interesting that you also pull it down to just communication, literally how we interact with each other. Like you said, that most violence happens as a result of that first contact and the positions that both people find themselves in that is adversarial by nature under the current structure. Whereas if we have a different structure with different best practices, then you're going to find a more humane approach. Again, back to getting the police officers to become a part of the community, or where you really have a sense that they're on your side and we're doing this together, and involving the community and all the community members and the value of those community members, regardless of background. And also, as you say, back to the peer support playing a vital important role, a vital role in that transformation.
That's right. I think another exciting area around policing is that what you're seeing now, and one of the points I often make is that the problems with policing are not about policing, are not only about policing, right? And so that gets to the point of the structural circumstances and the history. And I think what's exciting about policing, what's happening with policing now, is that communities are setting standards for what they expect from law enforcement. And that really flips it. I mean, in some ways, the last 20 years have been about law enforcement, as I was saying, recruiting the community into their objectives and that, you know, addressing some of their concerns, but not fundamentally rethinking the role of law enforcement in a community. And I think that we are definitely at a moment in parts of the country, including in Oakland, that people are rethinking the role of the police and kind of disrupting that monopoly that the police have had on young people in particular since the tough on crime shift.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, wow. Important work. Thank you so much. Anything else you want to add? Or?
No, I've really enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, it's a good one. I can't wait. This will be a good ad. And we didn't talk too much, so I think I can pull. I talked, and I'm glad. I'll just pull my pieces out as much as possible. And because, I like to have it coming from you, obviously. You're the expert, and the audience is interested in hearing what you've got to say. So, hallelujah. Are you tuned in at all to, Tulsi Gabbard, by chance?
No.
I would say check her out. Start checking her out. Because she's
her
Tulsi Gabbard, and she's a congresswoman from Hawaii. And she's
Yeah. That's right. Yes.
Mm-hmm. She's like poking, how should I say, ruffling the feathers a bit. But she's talking a lot about our foreign policy. But inherent in the message that she has, is this idea of, we need to be more thoughtful in general about everything we do and the manner in which we approach our world as a country. And she's a former military gal, and she keeps it together so well.
Mm-hmm.
When she's challenged, I'm like, whoa, this woman has learned the art of debate, because she does not let anyone throw her. And she just gives it right back, and she doesn't let anyone push her around, and she gives a very peaceful message in a very peaceful way, and yet she doesn't back down. She's like, look, it's just not smart. We got to do things differently, folks. It's that simple, So
that's
pretty
right.
cool. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah,
she's
calling it out. I'm like, go, Tulsi. And the key is, we all have to go donate to her campaign quickly, because even if it's just a dollar, because they're trying to push her out of the debate. So if she has to have,
what?
I think, something like 60,000, something like that many contributions in order to be able to get on the panel. So I'm like, yeah, that's on my to-do list. I've got to donate to her campaign.
That's good to know.
So just amongst your friends, pass the word so we can get, she's a progressive voice. She is the true progressive voice. And even maybe more than Bernie Sanders. Like, Bernie Sanders is out there, right? But she's I think she's more so than Bernie. I mean, she's got my vote. I'm for her.
Oh, wow. All right.
Yeah.
All
so
right.
She's
I'll
pretty
check
cool.
Her out.
Yeah, definitely. So anyway. All right. Well, thank you so much again.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
All right. And I'll let you know when these hit the air. These are shows I'm sort of putting, I kind of have to have a few evergreen shows, because I do local stories as well.
Yeah.
So it's sewn into that. It's sewn in. So it might take a while before it gets on there, but it will get on the airwaves. So.
Yeah. Well, the problem's not going to go away anytime soon.
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah, I hear you.
So awesome. Okay. All right.
Thanks so much.
Thank you again. Okay.
All right.
Take care. Bye-bye.